you'll see when we talk about burnout, we're talking about something that's more systemic than that and can't always be changed by those stress management techniques. Although we always recommend the stress management techniques as well. I'm going to pretty much go through the packet, so if you'll have at least some kind of access to one of these. Everyone at least have one or have a neighbor who has one so that you can follow along. You don't have one over in that corner. Can you pull up closer to somebody so you can see these? Okay. We've got some over here. We can have you actually add a chariot over here. When we talk about burnout, the first couple pages of the handout, you know, behind the outline, talk about the symptoms of burnout. And we're going to go over some of those. And what I want you to do is watch for which ones you think you're most prone to. We're stealing chairs from the slideshow, so you might be able to slip one out from the front of the slideshow. Basically, just some definitions of burnout. Burnout is exhaustion which comes from devotion to a cause or a way of life or a relationship. That's it. Exhaustion from devotion to a cause, a way of life, or a relationship which failed to produce the expected result. And I mean, it's both of those that are the key things. One is dedication to a cause, but it's when the cause fails to bring about the expected result that we're talking about burnout. Any kind of activity which doesn't have any return to it. People who, for example, people in the helping professions who know that that their work is only a minuscule part of what people need to reorganize their lives. I used to be an employment counselor and for a while did that with through a CETA program. Some of you may be aware of those. It was a Department of Labor program. And you're dealing with people whose lives are pretty minimally functional. And we were helping them to find jobs. Well, on the one hand, helping someone find a job is real helpful. On the other hand, most of us know that a job that pays $6 or $7 or $8 an hour isn't going to pull a family right up out of the poverty level and give them a real easy lifestyle. So doing that kind of work is an example of devotion to a cause which doesn't give the kind of payoff that one would need to have given. Burnout is also a result of accommodation in any kind of a situation where instead of being able to reach your goals or set goals and meet them, you're always having to accommodate. You're always having to deal with a less than perfect situation or even a less than good situation. And having to accommodate lack of resources, lack of influence, lack of power, all of those kinds of accommodation are things that contribute to burnout. It's described as a degenerative disease or a degenerative process which absorbs creativity, energy, and enthusiasm. It's just like, that's why we use the phrase burnout. Burnout is a phrase from the, you know, from like when the forest burns and it burns down essentially below the ground cover so that the ground is so depleted that it takes years for something to come back. And that's one way you can tell the difference between whether you have a simple sort of stress problem or whether you're involved in a burnout problem. People who are suffering from stress and want to deal with that, often by adding exercise or something, can feel their energy come back. If your problem is burnout, adding a little exercise program won't even begin to touch it. And that's why most of what we're going to talk about today is prevention for burnout. Because once you're in a burnout situation, the recovery time is quite extensive. Another cause for burnout, and I think that sometimes it can be one that, again, that people in the helping professions, maybe sometimes even the Christian church sort of nurtures this problem, and that is to live with an unrealistic expectation of goals or of what life will be like. And as long as your expectation of life is unrealistic, you will be working against impossible odds. You need me to move? So as long, one way we deal with people who are, who at least think that they're prone to burnout, is to help them develop realistic goals, because it's hanging on to unrealistic goals that makes it real difficult for people to avoid having burnout. Some of you know the writer Sam Keen, who sometimes uses the phrase, he says, instead of burnout, we ought to talk about people's situations of rusting out or freezing out. And it doesn't matter what image, but the point about burnout, it seems to be the where it got started, was that you can't burn out unless you've really had a passion for something. It's like burnout, therefore, becomes that disease which affects the very best of us. Because if you're sort of lukewarm and mediocre about your life and about your career and about your goals, you're not likely to be subject to burnout. You're not likely to get into goals that are beyond your reach. You're not likely to put yourself in a situation where you're trying to save the unsavable. But it's those people with real high ideals and real high expectations that get themselves in burnout situations. And so it's real unfortunate, because it thereby does sort of go after the very best of us. Gene Houston says, we are burning out because we are not using enough of ourselves. That is, and I talked a couple days ago about the Myers-Briggs learning style inventory and trying to help people identify what are your motivated goals. But very often, if you get yourself in a position where you can't use your best self, then you too are prone to burnout. Because it's your best self, the one that provides you with a lot of energy, that's going to sort of get you over the hard times. And another line that I used a couple of days ago, we've climbed the corporate ladder, Sam Keen says. We've climbed the corporate ladder and found out that it was up against the wrong wall. People who just invest and invest and invest and think, this is certainly going somewhere. And then when you're at the top, look around and say, is that all there is? Is that all there is? The symptoms of burnout are on the pages that look like this. And for those of you without handouts, we'll go ahead and read those. But what I'd like to do is listen for what you are most prone to. It seems to me the real trick in situations of burnout is for you to understand your own propensity toward burnout as a problem, to understand how it is you might first identify or feel those symptoms, and then go about correcting the problems. So just basic exhaustion. You go to bed tired at night, wake up tired the next morning, and you do that not just for a couple days or a week, but you do that week after week after week after week. You just don't want to get out of bed. Nothing refreshes you. It used to be that a little jog around the park would make you feel better. It takes enormous energy to get your tennis shoes on and to do the little jog around the park, and you don't feel better. I mean, then you're in the hands of something that isn't just a physical problem. Detachment. Now, detachment can be one of the very things that helps us. The part where you have a little distance from your work or from your project, where you can look at something you've done and instead of taking it all personally, you can say, that project just didn't go well. So detachment can be a good coping style. But when you find yourself detached from everything, when you find yourself just not invested in anything anymore, that's a good sign of burnout. When no matter what happens, you can sort of rationalize the effect of that on you, away from yourself, then what it means is you're moving out of your own life. It's like you're getting so much distance from your own life that you're not in it anymore. And that's a symptom of burnout. Boredom and cynicism. Those usually come when whatever it is that moves you the most isn't being used in terms of the kind of work that you're doing. And you get real bored and you get real cynical. And it doesn't matter what a good job you do. You're even cynical about your own success. It's like, well, anybody can do this if they just work 4 hours a day. So instead of really valuing your own work, you even become cynical about your own work. Impatience and heightened irritability. Some people may notice this in terms of relationships. Instead of being attentive to how it's affecting you, you may notice that you're crabbier than you used to be. On the other hand, maybe someone else will notice that you're crabbier than you used to be. Sometimes other people will notice burnout before we do. A sense of omnipotence, sort of the flip side of some of those others, but where you get to the place where you really believe you can solve all the problems. Again, that's a kind of a distortion of reality. So the more you think that you're in charge of everything, the more you're likely to be experiencing burnout. The suspicion of being unappreciated. You know, that's like the poster there's one right here about paranoia. It says just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that somebody really isn't out to get you, right? When it used to be, that you would be real satisfied with whatever you were doing, with being appreciated, and suddenly no one appreciates your work. You know, the boss doesn't appreciate your work, your family doesn't appreciate your work, your spouse doesn't appreciate your work. What it means, of course, is that at some very deep level you don't appreciate. You've lost the energy to appreciate yourself. Or the suspicion that people are out to get you. Make a list of the three people who really are and see if your list is longer than that. Psychosomatic complaints. Some people will experience burnout in terms of aches and pains, back pain, headaches that won't go away. You go to the doctor can't figure out what's wrong. There are also real physical complaints, but this suggestion is that there's aches and pains where there's no reason. The last three that are suggested are depression, just basic flat, nothing seems to matter. You cry for no reason. You're just sad most of the time. Can't seem to get any energy. Disorientation, just can't seem to focus on things. You sort of flip from thing to thing. And denial of feelings. Something happens to you and someone says, you must be really disappointed about that. And you go, no, it doesn't matter. No, it wasn't important. So those are the symptoms of burnout. What I'd like you to do, there may be people in the room who are in stages of, wonderful health or stages of burnout. What I believe, though, is that each of us has sort of one of these that we are more prone to than any other, even when we are healthy. And if you can identify those, then you're likely to be able to identify the one that you're going to be into if you are, in fact, experiencing burnout. Seems to me the reason for going to a workshop like this when you're not burned out is so that you can hear someone talk about what the effects are and begin to anticipate if that's going to be a problem for you. So what I'd like you to do is just turn and talk to someone near you and see if any one of these is something that you are prone to do when you're under some kind of stress that may in fact be getting at you. In terms of somehow like the ways that we're often accustomed to seeing some of these styles that often end up in burnout are the whiner. It's like somebody just, their voice goes up a little bit and nothing's since ever really very good. Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, who go out, searching for impossible tasks. And some of this, I must admit, sort of strikes me in the heart. There's a part of me that is idealistic enough that says, if we only did what we can do, there wouldn't be a lot of things happening in the world. So I must admit, I guess it's the part of me that, again, has that tendency to burnout that says, well, what about, taking on really difficult tasks? Well, the difference is, that's an impossible task. And difficult tasks do deserve to be taken on. Impossible tasks need to be hacked up into things that are manageable. So the Don Quixote, Sancho Panza. So the extent to which you are sort of enamored by people who take on impossible tasks is probably the part of you that is prone to burnout too. The scapegoat. If you are someone you know is always the scapegoat of every situation, that's a style that's going to get itself in trouble. It's already in trouble in terms of scapegoat, but it's going to be in trouble over the long haul. Workaholic. Some of that is related to that type A stress person, and we'll talk about that a little more. But clearly a workaholic is a person who's on the way to burnout. An alcoholic is on his or her way to burnout. the silent sufferers, those people who just sort of take on more and more and more. And most of us know somebody who, in fact, maybe most of us are somebody who, it's like if there's a project that needs to be done, you know, they say call a busy person, you know, and if you're the one that they call, no matter what they need, if there's, you know, one more spot on the list, and your name always goes in there, someone always says, you could always expect good old Sharon to do that, then you're likely to be on the way to burnout. You want to get your name off that list. That sort of silent sufferer who will always take up the slack for everybody else. Always the last person in the office to stay and finish packets when the packets need to be done, because the other people always have better excuses for leaving early. Hypochondriac, we mentioned that. The selfaholic, that is the person who's so self-contained that they don't ask for help from anyone else or don't share things with anyone else. Those people are prone to burnout. And that opposite person, the helpaholic, who gets his or her meaning by getting involved in everybody else's project and really doesn't have any life of his or her own, simply wants to help you with your stuff. Because what happens is that they haven't made a decision then about what's important to them. Now I know, I mean, the more we talk, the closer we're getting to somebody in the room, right? And that's the whole point. I mean, if we want to be sure to see ourselves here. If you think about this, I mean, the punchline of the workshop on burnout is that if you're not living a balanced life, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And if you're on the idealist side and you tend to be real passionate about things that you like and tend to commit yourself real well to things, then burnout is likely to be the problem. Every problem, it seems to me, is a problem of balance, problem of having things in balance in our lives. And the skew on the burnout side is on the side of these kinds of behaviors. Well, the reason I included the title for the talk is the burnout is for the birds, is that I have these analogies of these birds. The first bird is the phoenix. Second bird is the pelican. Third bird is the ostrich. And the last bird is the peacock. Okay, we'll do those birds and then I'll have you figure out which bird you're more likely to be. You know what? There's a chair here that I'm not going to use. If anybody wants this chair. It's okay. Sorry. Yeah. I even picked a padded chair because I've been sitting so much. I'm not going to sit in a hard chair. I'm not going to sit at all. Okay, the phoenix. Most of us know the symbol of the phoenix. In the Christian church, it's used as a symbol of resurrection. The phoenix is a bird. It's almost always presented as a male bird who lives for 100 years. And I don't know how the little bugger knows it, but on his 100th birthday, he goes crashing down into a fire and is burned up. And in the Christian myth, he comes back, but that's a symbol of resurrection. But if you live your life like a phoenix, you're not coming back. It's like you go to work someday, you're not coming back. You give and give and give and give and give with that kind of intensity, and you're not coming back. And that's the most real picture of burnout is the phoenix, who is, and some of these are related to things we're talking in terms of stress management, is a perfectionist, gets real committed to causes, and literally has blinders on, gets so focused on one area of his or her life, or one issue, that they burn themselves up, often in search of something that was impossible, something that they couldn't pull off. The phoenix is a wonderful symbol. The problem with the phoenix is that the behaviors of the phoenix are in fact reinforced and validated in many places. They're reinforced and validated in the churches when we ask our pastors to work 80 and 90 hours a week. They're validated in the workplace where, you know, where if you're the one who takes on more and more and more work, you do rise up the little corporate ladder that way. We have a lot of stuff in our culture that values the performance of the phoenix. to take more and more on, to be real single-minded. But it's a doom bird in terms of burnout. There's just not enough energy available to anyone to get that kind of focus, and they do burn out. People who are real time conscious, you know, people who are always late or always absolutely punctual, and who, when they get there on time, just fume when other people are late. Hate to wait in lines. It's like every minute belongs to somebody else. It's not even as if every minute is important. Every minute belongs to somebody else. If you feel in control of your own time, you know, you can sing a song when you're waiting at a red light or waiting in a traffic jam. The problem with the Phoenix is that all of that stuff is usually outer directed. In fact, we're going to talk a little later about the people who can survive some of this are people who have a goal of their own where there is, in fact, something coming back. You can sometimes get away with that kind of intensity around certain kinds of activities as long as you know there's a goal and you're the one who's getting something back for your goal. But as long as your goal is real outer directed and either belongs to the company or something outside of you, you're on your way to a burnout kind of a situation. Any questions about the behavior of the Phoenix, that sort of type A person?
What's the waiting in lines have to do with the saying a person does not like to wait in lines?
Yeah, they don't like to wait in lines because they think it's a waste of time. Well, see, if it's something is a waste of time, it means you're supposed to be doing something else at the time. And it usually is people whose schedules are so busy, they haven't allowed themselves the luxury of what for everybody is sort of a normal situation, you know, traffic jams, you know, lines in grocery stores, and so forth. So to be impatient around anything that looks like an interruption is a sign of, you know, really pushing the limits.
I disagree with you. I think lines are not normal. I think that's a very abnormal part of North American life. It is quite ridiculous.
What do we do about it?
There's a recent survey, I think it's about 2 weeks ago it was released, where this fellow said that the average American spends about 6 years of their life waiting in line.
The average Russian about
30. And the average Russian about 30. Okay, interesting. Yeah, a lines may not be the ideal, and the recommendation would be if lines are something that bother you, that you would pace yourself in such a way that you'd shop at 11 o'clock at night when there are no lines,
right.
That you would schedule your work time, you know, going to work and going home at times, and avoid rush hour. And you can do that and be managing your life well. That's not particularly the sign of a Phoenix. But the sign of a Phoenix is when anything interrupts that, you know, it's like that nosedive on the way back to the fire, it's an interruption. Instead of, for most people, being an opportunity to breathe or sing or do the things that the more relaxed people would do. Okay, the second bird is the pelican. Now, you may be a little less familiar with the pelican. The pelican, and again, this is primarily from mythology, the pelican is primarily a female symbol. And the pelican, remember, that's the one with the big beak that doesn't have a voice. For one thing, the pelican doesn't speak much, and the story was that when the pelican couldn't get food for her young, that with that very strong beak she would simply devour her own stomach and then feed her young off of her own body. Well, it's not a popular thing for pelicans, but it is a popular thing for people. Most of us know how many times we make choices for other people before we make choices for ourselves. And that sort of the symbol of making choices for children happens probably the most often. That it's like, you know, it's time for new shoes, who gets new shoes? You know, the kids get new shoes. So it's a lifestyle which consistently puts other people's needs ahead of her own needs in this case. And of course, the Phoenix, even though it's a male symbol, isn't just men. And the pelican, even though it's a female symbol, isn't just women. But all of us who always say, what does everybody else need here instead of what do I need here, are on the road to becoming pelicans, who will in fact devour ourselves rather than save ourselves for the long haul. And those are absolute styles that contribute to burnout. And it strikes me that this is the one that for most Christians is the hardest to hear, because we have so much in our tradition that says, Jesus, others, and you. There are just lots and lots and lots of those things that make us think that thinking of ourselves is a selfish thing to do. It's absolutely an essential thing to do, to think of ourselves. And to the extent, it doesn't mean that you never will make choices for someone else to get something and you not to get something. It's the pattern that's important. And the pattern of the pelican is to always be giving, always be giving, always be giving, and giving at the expense of themselves. Question about the pelican? Doesn't that make sense? There's a line from Christopher Fry, which I really like. He says, what's a halo? One more thing to keep clean. It's a halo, one more thing to keep clean. The problem with the pelican, of course, is that, that pelican becomes a silent sufferer because the pelican doesn't have a voice. So the pelican never complains about the fact that everyone else's needs are met, but not her own, or his own. The third bird is the ostrich, and the ostrich, again, we're talking about the myths of these birds, but the ostrich, puts his head in the sand and says, what I don't see wasn't going to bother me, what I don't see won't affect me. Other lines like, it can't get worse. It can get worse, Mm-hmm. Essentially, the ostrich's style is a denial style. It says, if I don't know about this, I don't have to do anything about it. And I lived for a good number of years using that style myself, so I know how dangerous it is. I even remember one time, and I must have been coming out of it or I wouldn't even remember it, but I smelled, how when you first turn the furnace on in the fall and it smells a little dusty? I don't remember if this was the fall or not, but the furnace smelled like that. And so I thought, there could be a fire here. This could be a real serious problem. My first impulse, I have to admit, was to go to bed. Was that if I would go to sleep, I won't have to do anything about this. And I know that comes from lots of years as a kid of sleeping, so I wouldn't have to take care of my parents' problems. But denial is a style that we use a lot. Denial can even be, my husband will take care of it, or my wife will take care of it. Simply putting it off to someone else, something that really is your own business. Or simply to not be willing to take a problem sort of step by step. It's the belief that you can't handle your own problems, essentially. It's a belief that I'm going to just hold my breath until it goes away. Well, most of our situations don't go away. So the ostrich's style of denial and denying themselves isn't going to work. The last bird is the peacock. And I think the peacock is an antidote to all those other birds. And again, I don't know a lot about peacocks in real life, but I do know about them sort of in mythology. And I know enough to know that peacocks require a great deal of care. What I've read about peacocks is that the peacock eggs have to be kept at a very constant temperature or they won't hatch. They require incredible amounts of nurturing and care. And the peacock, then, the one that's famous in the zoo, is the one who sort of walks around and everyone says how wonderful they are. And that's all they do is walk around and be wonderful. Which is, unlike any of these other birds that we just met. But it seems to me that at least in terms of a corrective on the side of folks who are prone to burnout is the mindset of the peacock. And that is to stop, putting everything out there. Stop, putting everything away from yourself and to take some time to genuinely and gently nurture yourself. And, there are all sorts of strategies for doing that, and I'll have you talk about that with each other in just a minute. Because it's absolutely essential that in some way some part of life that we get invested in come back to us. And we need to get that both from other people. We need other people to admire our work and our being. And we need to stop and admire our own work and our being ourselves. Question about the sort of the myth of the peacock. Okay, I have the joke here. This is the joke here for those of you who don't have it. Is a guy with his desk full of work, and his chart has lots of activity on the business side and nothing on the pleasure side. That's supposed to represent the phoenix. There's an eight-question survey called Unrealistic Personal Assessment. I want you to look through those eight statements and see which of those you are more prone toward. And again, there may be more than one. Yeah, those of you who have them and, you know, hold them up enough so that people near you can see them. Uh-huh. Or keep everybody else
happy.
Sort of down so that they won't interrupt.
Keep everybody happy.
Yeah.
Or else it's going to affect me.
Yeah. That's a real tough one.
Especially when you're 3 days in a car.
Oh.
You have to learn how to.
If it's your job to be responsible for the emotional health of other people as well, that's even harder. So, yeah. And that's not uncommon. Is how many people you are responsible for someone else's emotional health? Sure, almost. Yeah, that's a real common one to get into. Okay. My needs are less important than those of my children, spouse, boss, coworkers, clients. I think it means several of the above. How many people have that one?
Half been.
Gave that one up. Okay. Got a few of those out there though. Why is that? Why are our needs less important than all these other folks? What are the belief systems behind some of these things? And it's, well, goodness knows it's reinforced by these folks. Come on. Yeah, this doesn't take very long to get this one acclimated in your old family. Especially if you have children, my goodness. They adore it when they're first. Yeah, they'll keep that going as long as possible. It's only when they get to be as tall as you and you seem to think this isn't fair anymore. Almost any system where you start out less important than all of the above will work very hard to keep you in that place because it serves their needs real well. And they may do that unconsciously or consciously. But part of the reason where I'm saying this is to let you know that it's essential that you get out of these mindsets, and it's not easy to get out of these mindsets. It's very difficult. But the third one, I am the only person really capable of handling this problem. How many of you get into those? And it's like, it's because it's my job, or I really know what else is going on here, or I could be more fair with everyone. Any others? What are the other belief systems behind this?
I'm the only one who knows how to do it.
Really? And I tend to keep it that way. Right. Yeah, see, what starts out as something that it helps us with our self-esteem, we think. It's like we play one side of that. It helps us stay in control of a situation. But the downside of that is it's going to burn you out. So we don't often think of the downside. Number four, if everyone who I feel is important does not like what I'm doing, then I must be a failure. How many people just hate criticism? Just don't want people to not like anything they do. Yeah. How many of you who really like criticism want us to criticize? No.
True.
Yeah.
The martyrs. Yes.
Yeah, that's the silent sufferers who are always doing it wrong. The key issue in here is it's like if everyone who I feel is important does not like what I'm doing, then they don't like what I'm doing. I mean, it's the line that follows. It doesn't mean that you're a failure. There may be many times you're called upon to do things. But that is a tricky one, particularly if you're prone to the ones above, that everyone else's well-being is more important than yours. It's critically important for me to be unfailingly competent. No, I try. How many of you have that one?
Just don't try it.
Yeah. This could be a real problem. If you do have a tendency toward being a perfectionist, then you only take things on that you can do perfectly. Which, on the one hand, keeps your self-esteem pretty intact. I'm going to do stuff on self-esteem and self-concept next week. But keeps your self-esteem intact. However, you have a limited sense of yourself because you haven't tried anything that you know you're going to fail at. You know, well, there is a bumper sticker out there that says anything worth doing is even worth doing poorly.
I don't like the word unfailingly. I would say that I have to try and be competent, but I can fail. It's not going to be the end of the world if I fail.
Well, that's where the catch is.
Even a question that says, it's like I have to do everything I do to the best of my ability. See, how many believe that? That softens us a little, but it's still a dangerous one, see? To have to do everything you do the very best you can, it means you can't prioritize between where your energy goes.
And you play a mediocre game of ping pong once in a while.
Yeah, right. Yeah, lighten up a little. Well, someone who isn't going to think that you're totally incompetent. So. Yeah. Oh, yeah, if you're not going to do anything, you better do it well.
Do your best in school, do your best in your test, do your best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are basically new rules. What'd you say?
I said my son gave those up. I did enough of them.
Yeah, you did enough of both of you. Yeah. My worth as a person depends on how much I achieve or produce. You have some of those? Those are sort of subtle. Sometimes we don't even know we believe that. But it's like you sort of look around behind you, and when you had to make a list of the things that you're really pleased about, you know, it's like you want to list real projects or real things you've done. Then you know that this is likely to be a problem.
Single spaced 4-page view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't summarize a resume if this is a big report. Right? It's terrible when things don't go the way I want them to. Is that a big one for me? Yeah, it's just terrible. I mean, it's like, and how can you be in charge of that much? I mean, it's just too many things out of your control. So you're real vulnerable if that's a concern for you. And yet, you know, a lot of systems reinforce this. We want you to plan something, and if it doesn't turn out well, you're supposed to think you did something wrong. We want someone to take the blame, right? When others disapprove of me, it invariably means I am wrong or bad.
Yeah.
Oh, we got lots of those. Oh, now do you see what a burden this is to live under? Yeah. It really is a burden to live under. It seems to me that one meaningful exercise, just to use with this piece of paper, is to write these statements over and over and over again. Right. In some way that's right. In some way that carries some affection for your humanness, some affection for your frailties, some affection for your not being perfect, some affection for the fact that there will always be somebody who isn't going to think you're doing it right. Because see, they've got a list like this too. And if they think you're doing it right, then they have to admit that they were wrong. So it might be real useful to look at these lines and try to figure out, Why is this so important to me? Why is this so hard to let go of? And then try to write, it's like those one of those true-false tests where if you write the line right, you get it right. Work with these until you figure out, you know, what's reasonable here? How can I help lighten up on myself? Because we're the ones who are doing all this stuff to ourselves. And we may have people around us who are supporting this kind of behavior because it's very functional. But it's not functional in the long run. And it's not functional in the long run for our personal selves either. So you might want to do that, is rework these statements until you think they are the statements that ought to guide the lives of healthy people, which is sort of what you're on your way to becoming. The top of the outline on the second page talks about solutions in antidotes to burnout. They've done some studies with those people, all those type A people who they thought would have heart attacks, and discovered that some of them aren't having heart attacks. Some of them are not being burned out. Some of them are really feeling energized by their work. Because what we know, what we don't want to go for, I mean, the alternative to a lifestyle which contributes to burnout is not lukewarm, wishy-washy, uninvolved. That's not the alternative to burnout. The suggestion is that these four qualities are the things that people need to avoid burnout. And let me get these up. Okay, somebody want to read those to me?
Challenge.
Okay. These four qualities are the kinds of things that, in fact, allow us to carry that same kind of intensity and passion that we have for life and not be burned out. First one is challenge. And the, maybe more related to control. But the thing about the challenge, the way challenge was different for the people who didn't experience burnout is that they were challenged for something for themselves. It's like they were invested in it. They weren't doing it all for someone else. You know, it wasn't somebody who got in the company and sort of gave his life for Sperry Rand. The challenge becomes a personal challenge. Setting goals for oneself and reaching those goals. So people do like challenge. And we all like challenge. And that's one thing we want to keep in there. Commitment. The commitment to that realistic kind of a cause, or at least a part where you can have some kind of effect. We don't particularly want to give up those tasks that are impossible, like feeding the world. On the other hand, you want to do something where you can actually make a commitment to a specific kind of behavior and do something and see some effect of that. Matters of control. That you have some control over your own involvement in a project, some control over your own behavior, that you're not real passive and not always dependent on other people's responses for what the outcome will be for you. And these other, quality that these type A people have who don't experience burnout is that they have intimate relationships which are real important to them. They are absolutely connected with other people. They are not isolated. They don't become like the workaholic where work takes them away from things that are important. They have real important primary connections with other people. See, the reason that some of those same qualities without the balance in it doesn't work is that we essentially deplete our human resources. We don't have coming back to us what we need as human beings to survive. And this is the correction, at least for those people who want to stay real intense. These folks, they're called hardy personalities, had all of those characteristics in common. The challenge was something that they could get involved in. The commitment was something that they could measure, that they had some control over, and they stayed very connected with people in their lives who were important to them. I have a worksheet in here. On the next page, there's a quote by Erik Erikson, which I'll read. Freud was once asked what he thought a normal person should be able to do well. The questioner probably expected a complete, a deep answer, but Freud simply said, love and work, to love and to work. It pays to ponder on the single formula. It grows deeper as you think about it. Work, as can any other activity in our lives, can be a deeply enriching and meditative experience. It all depends on the attitude we carry to it. Approaching work with care and awareness can transform even the most mundane tasks into an exciting opportunity to reflect and grow. This attitude is reflected in most spiritual traditions. And then I have a little article about, I mean, a short article about work from Zen and the Art of Everyday Work. There's a worksheet next that where there, I've created sort of a grid around the things that that we all need in our lives. We need, and these are as you'll see, our opposites. We need structure and order. We also need freedom and creativity. We need power and influence, and we also need relationships and inclusion. And these are just the sort of the categories of life that I thought of. You may have some other way of building those categories. We have work and career, we have family, friendships and social life, hobbies, recreation, leisure, and community, church, and politics. We don't have to have structure and order in all of these places, but we need some place where we have some kind of control over our lives, some structure and some order. If you don't have that, you know, part of your life anywhere, then you need to add that. What this is, for me anyway, is sort of a worksheet to deal with the problems in burnout, which are a lack of balance, a lack of something coming back if everything's going out, a lack of realistic goals if you're into the impossible. So what I recommend that people do with this is to look at the various aspects of their lives and figure out what's missing. You know, what is it? You know, some people maybe have too much structure and order. I mean, maybe think everything is so ordered that there's no life in anything. It's like you can't bring anything to anything. You can't affect any change because the way we're doing it now is so important that we keep doing it that way. Then what you want to do is introduce some freedom and creativity in some part of your life. It might mean doing more imaginative things with a friend. So that might get acted out in terms of your friendship systems. You might take on a new hobby. And that would be the way you would work that out. Same with power and influence and relationships and inclusion. If you get into a lot of secondary kinds of relationships and focus a lot on issues of power and affecting change at sort of at that secondary level and have neglected intimate relationships, then that's going to be a big hole. And you're going to want to find some place to fill that. Well, maybe work isn't the place to do that. I mean, maybe work is a place that is a real secondary system for you. And maybe it isn't appropriate to be building intimate relationships there. But it's important to build those somewhere. So you might want, again, to do that in terms of your friendship or your family. I mean, maybe it's time to get closer to someone in your family. It seems to me that the real issues around burnout are belief systems that are unrealistic, belief systems that have come from an era that where the expectations were, in fact, too hard. We're living too long to live with some of the expectations that people lived with, you know, 40 and 50 years ago. We have to manage ourselves, most of us, for, you know, 80 or 90 or 100 years. And we are experiencing many different kinds of problems than we had that many years ago. The issues of balance, the issues of our becoming whole are even more important now. And it's critical for your own health and for the health of people around you that you save yourself, you know, for the long haul. And I think, you know, that working out some of these issues might do that. The last page, and we're getting close to five, the last page is a list, again, of a whole variety of things you might want to do. It says, skills and strategies for coping with stress. You might want to use this page in connection with that one where the eight statements, you know, which ones are you the most prone to. Because, for example, if you are prone to always doing things for other people, to being real outer-directed, to being real focused on what other people think of you, and if they don't like something of being real unhappy, then you might want to work on some of the issues 1 through 6, which has to do with making choices for yourself, learning to say no, learning to value the parts of you that don't want to say yes to some other things. But why don't you, just for a minute, I realize it's time to go, but look at that list. See if you can make a decision about any one of those things that you would do first. Which one, if you do one of those things, will make the biggest difference to you in terms of your dealing with the kinds of impossible situations, the kinds of impossible demands, the kinds of tendencies of the whole world to pull you over into their corner without giving you enough air for you to live your own life. Now the whole page. See, I think if you make, again, we talked about this with the stress management, if you make a choice to do any one thing and do it, you're on your way. What you don't want to do is take home a whole list like this. And again, I mean, if we're all the people with all those problems, we don't need a list like this to make us feel even more inadequate. Choose one, any one. Try to choose the one that you think will make the biggest difference for you. But choose the one you think you can do. You know, choose the one that you think would be possible, given your time constraints, your money restraints, your family restraints. But choose one that you think will make a difference. Yeah, I would hope that when you look at those statements, that you would maybe remember what it was that sort of got you to that point and try very hard. It's like, you know, chew the inside of your mouth before you say all those things to your kids. Don't say to your kids, if you can't do anything well, don't do it at all. I mean, if you're 7 or 4, can you do anything well? I mean, what kind of a mindset is that for, even for a teenager? They're supposed to be trying lots of stuff, failing at lots of stuff on the way to figuring out what they want to do. If you start life with, if you can't do anything well, don't do anything at all, you don't explore very many options. Yeah, that's a real important point. Yeah, the reason this is so hard for us, most of us, is that we heard some of these lines from childhood. And we need to give ourselves that the same kind parent lines that we would wish for our own children. Some people have learned how to become good parents to themselves by being horrified at what they've been doing with their own children. That certainly was my experience. When I had 3 little kids real fast, and when I realized that there was nothing my 2-year-old boy could do to express his anger, I knew that there was something wrong with me. And many of us have learned how to parent ourselves well because we would not tolerate the kind of parenting we were on our way to doing with our own children. So, you know, you can get clues about yourself from anywhere. But the goal is to learn to love yourself and have an affection for the most inept of your skills. Everybody loves the things you do well. You know, who is it that loves and cherishes the things you do poorly?
I think it's important, too, not to allow siblings to put down the other ones. Mm-hmm. Because that's just as hard as an older sibling putting down the younger one.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects them all their lives.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Did everybody find one thing you're going to do? Tell somebody. Tell somebody what you're going to do.